For our audience of blind or print-impaired listeners, your North Carolina Reading Service now brings you... The Indie Week, a weekly presentation, and it's read this week by John Feddersen, and the issue dated December the 11th of 2025. Well, unlikely to be an important story for really weeks on end is immigration enforcement. And this first article is about the Board of Education in Durham is going to vote on a policy towards immigration enforcement. On November 18, when Customs and Border Agents, CBP, arrived in the Triangle, about 20% of Durham Public Schools' 330,000 students stayed home, as parents worried about agents showing up to schools, bus stops, and pickup lines. There was no confirmed activity at schools, but with a federal administration that has been set on increasing deportation numbers, in part by targeting liberal cities, DPS families have been on edge. The majority member Durham Association of Educators, DAE, says teachers are not prepared in the event agents return. President Mika Tweetmeyer told Indy via email, "The fact of the matter is, when CPB or ICE came to town, frontline staff never received training on what to do if they came to the door or approached our students or co-workers. This is a big failing on the DPS administration's part." Last month's deportation sweep added urgency to an already inflammatory debate between DPS administration, educators, and families. What can the district, with a large immigrant community and 35% Hispanic-Latino student population, plan to do if targeted by a vicious federal administration? And who should know about those plans? Superintendent Anthony Lewis has argued that principals know the procedures and that publicizing those plans would make them less effective and could even bring more unwanted attention to Durham. And the Board of Education has indicated that it can only go so far in trying to protect students from a vindictive executive branch that may decide to target immigrants in Durham. But educators and some families have said they would feel safer if the district had a more public-facing policy. Megan McCurley, as a DPS parent with family members who are immigrants, told the Indy at a meeting between DPS and DAE before the arrival in the Triangle, "A private policy doesn't give us any assurances, it doesn't tell us what to expect, and it doesn't give us any tools to hold accountable or to know if the principal of our school is doing what they're expected to do." The DPS Board of Education, clearly spooked by November's enforcement surge, has started moving closer to the DAE's requests and nudging Lewis to move with them. That's a familiar dynamic in the district. The board's elected officials are trying to prove they are listening to community members, while the superintendent's team is trying to safeguard the district. Several board members have indicated they would like to vote on some policy additions at the meeting on December 11th, even if they then revisit them right away in January. The policy and procedures in question are not just about theory and values. There are real risks to DPS families. Trump's Department of Homeland Security has said it doesn't intend to raid schools, but in January, the administration rescinded a policy that discouraged ICE agents from carrying out enforcement activities in, quote, sensitive locations like courthouse, hospitals, and schools. Prior to the arrival of federal immigration agents in November, Durham has previously been singled out by the Trump administration. Earlier this year, the Department of Homeland Security labeled Durham a sanctuary jurisdiction, though Durham officials denied that characterization. Durham City Council also declared the city a, quote, Fourth Amendment workplace, which made national headlines. DAE is trying to push the superintendent and board to try to protect students even outside of school grounds, including on their daily commutes to and from school. That's partly prompted by memories of the 2016 arrest of Wildin Acosta, an undocumented then Riverside High School student senior who was detained by ICE. That was under the Obama administration as he headed to school. DA Representative Allison Swaim said, "What is the protocol if ICE were to come near or on campus? What do we do if ICE doesn't have a warrant and they are wanting to come on campus? How might we recognize suspected immigration enforcement vehicles?" While many educators have said they would physically intervene if their students were targeted, the superintendent has been adamant that the district cannot and will not ask staff to put themselves at risk. Dr. Lewis and the Board of Ed continue to carefully consider a wide range of issues related to federal law enforcement and have a detailed plan to vet warrants and ensure FERPA compliance, said DPS Chief Communications Officer Sheena Cooper via email. Lewis has also said publicly that he's worried about drawing more attention to Durham. At a meeting in October, Lewis even convinced the DAE to cut off the ongoing live stream, meant to allow greater accessibility for those who couldn't make it to an in-person meeting on a Tuesday night. Lewis said, "I will not put any student or any family or this district or this county in jeopardy by having a conversation like this that's being broadcast and recorded. I simply will not do that." Parenthetically, the superintendent also left the conference table to ask the Indy, the only recognizable news outlet in the room, to stop recording and not report on that portion of the meeting, arguing that it wasn't a public meeting. The meeting, a meet-and-confer session with DAE representatives, was convened under Board Policy 7215, which states that meet-and-confer sessions will be open to the public in compliance with NC Open Meetings Law. The Indy declined to stop their recording. The superintendent's fears are not entirely unfounded. In the next-door Chapel Hill Carborough system, superintendent and board chair have been summoned to a North Carolina House of Representative oversight hearing after the rabble-rousing libs of TikTok, in quotes, posted a clip of Board of Ed Chair George Griffin discussing the district's decision to say no thanks to parts of the NC General Assembly's Parents' Bill of Rights. On November 20, the Durham School Board unanimously passed a resolution that details that any requests by immigration officials to enter schools should be reviewed by the superintendent. The district shall provide families with information about their rights, and the superintendent shall, quote, ensure training for all school personnel on the district's protocols for responding to requests from immigration authorities. Several of those provisions were actually already in a DPS policy passed back in 2017. Then board member Mike Lee said then, "I think we can lead the way here in letting other districts know this is how we protect our students." But at some point between 2017 and 2020, that policy was revised without a vote. The board is supposed to have sole policy-making power, but the policy was apparently unintentionally stripped of several provisions by a bureaucratic shuffle of policy reordering and consolidation. With a series of crises like teacher pay and transportation and now an enrollment drop, the board has been playing a game of whack-a-mole rather than doing much proactive policy planning. The board's newly formed policy committee has been eyeing that policy regarding immigration enforcement for revision, but it only took it up this month after spending recent meetings wordsmithing a draft for a state-mandated school day cell phone ban that the legislature requires districts to have in place by January. At the December meeting of that policy committee, board members discussed reinstating those 2017 provisions, though Deputy Superintendent Tanya Giovanni said they are already a part of DPS procedure. Board members, though likely feeling pressure from the public, said that putting them back into policy could serve as a good starting point for future revisions. Lewis also indicated that he's more inclined to consider DAE's suggestions than he was prior to the CPB sweeps. He says the district has started to procure thousands of so-called red cards, which allow outline people's rights if they are approached by law enforcement, and will soon make them available to students and families. Tweet Meyer, the DEE president, called the resolution a good first step, but added, quote, "We are not confident that administration will act to protect our students and colleagues short of the board mandating it through policy." DEE has floated a draft of an updated policy with provisions and protections that go far beyond the 2017 version. The draft states, quote, "Non-local law enforcement are not permitted to arrest any students on school premises or at a school event. This includes parking lots, bus stops, on buses, sporting events, meetings, dances, field trips in any part of the school building, classrooms, traveling to and from school, a school event, etc." Even with pressure from educators and families, board members have indicated that they are unlikely to try to extend a broad bubble of protection beyond school buildings. In conversations around the recent resolution and policy changes, members repeatedly asked the board's lawyer how legally sound the language was and backed away from anything they saw as potential overreach. Cooper, the district communications officer, told Indy the district is, quote, "carefully reviewing the policy change with our legal counsel and will communicate openly with staff, families, and provide resources to help navigate these changes." At that meeting on December 11th, the board will consider updating its policy with the 2017 provisions, and the administration will somewhat reluctantly bring an update on the district's procedures, though administrators have promised that the update will be sufficiently vague. Board members say that some movement is better than none. Natalie Beyer, board member, said in December, "Board members say that some movement is better than none. The community wants to see progress, not perfection." Next article, also from Durham, the Durham City Council is delaying a major development at former police headquarters. Redeveloping Durham's former headquarters will have to wait a little longer. The four-acre lot in downtown has sat vacant since 2018. The Durham City Council heard a presentation during its work session last week where city staff recommended against pursuing redevelopment of the full site, citing costs. Instead, staff recommended the city subdivide that lot to sell the historic Milton Small building to a preservation nonprofit and explore interim uses like open space that could host public art, pop-up markets, or events while waiting for economic conditions to improve. For the lot's neighbors, Duke Memorial United Methodist Church, and many others in Durham, building affordable housing is a priority. Reverend Mick Rayner, a pastor at Duke Memorial UMC, said at the meeting his congregation wants to see an affordable housing on the lot as soon as possible. The church sits directly across from the former police headquarters. Rayner said rent and utility assistance requests from church members have increased from 7 or 8 a month to 18 to 20 a month as the need for affordable housing has continued to grow. Rayner said, "We are in an affordable housing crisis. At Duke Memorial on West Chapel Hill Street, we are seeing people being turned away every month for rent assistance as they look at 505 West Chapel, directly across the street from them, at a vacant lot that could be used for safe, clean, and affordable housing for 100 or more families as soon as possible. The council back in 2018 identified affordable housing as its top priority for that site. Since then, the site has been through several false starts with developers amid poor market conditions and high construction cost. Most recently, last June, the council voted to end its negotiation with the development team led by the Peebles Company, saying the parties, quote, were not able to reach mutually agreeable terms and conditions for site redevelopment. On Thursday, the council heard from city staff and development consulting firm HR&A that, due to high construction costs and interest rates, options for developing the full site now would require, quote, significant subsidies. HR&A said, noting multiple downtown projects are facing similar economic headwinds. What's more, building what is feasible on the site would underutilize it and undermine its future development potential. HR&A presented council with three short-term options for the site: preserving the Milton Small Building, preserving the building and adding open space for interim uses, and creating an affordable housing in addition to open space and the existing building. They also presented three long-term scenarios, each preserving the Milton Small Building. One, maximizing open space. One, creating a commercial hub on most of the site. And another, creating a dense mixed-use development. But the affordable housing option could hinder how the site can be used in the future. Building affordable housing would likely require a competitive 9% low-income housing tax credit, LIHTC, said Mark Kubasik, director of community development company HR&A. And using the tax credit would come with conditions on how the site could be developed, such as requiring surface parking that would limit other uses of the site. Council members said they want to see more affordable housing options for that lot. Member Nate Baker said the site has seen numerous attempts to go through full redevelopment in a hot market, and it hasn't happened. And we know that affordable housing is in demand. I think it would be worth our time to do a deeper dive and explore what is possible around affordable housing. The council asked staff to come back with more information on affordable housing and parking options for that site by the end of March. To begin rehabilitation of the Milton Small Building, which previously served as the Durham Police Department headquarters, the city will likely have to subdivide the property and sell the building to Preservation North Carolina. Rehabbing the building is estimated to cost at least $25 to $30 million. The building could be used as market rate or affordable housing, a hotel, or an office, but the longer it deteriorates, the more costly it is to repair. Kathleen Turner, Piedmont Office Regional Director of Preservation North Carolina, said, if we can help problem solve this portion of the larger site so you can focus on the complexities of the other portion, that's what we're offering to do, to try to get this ox cart that's been stuck in the ditch for a good long while. But before any decisions on the site's future, Councilmember Chelsea Cook said she wanted more information about what affordable housing and parking could look like. And she said, for me, I'm like, 100 units now is better if they are done more cost-effectively. And then in 10 years, we find we are literally out of the market for building any units at all, right? Like what might happen, which has happened on this site, we've changed direction three different times and we have no units. Whereas if we had built 8 years ago, there's the possibility that we would already have people housed. Well, let's look over to Raleigh now and Enloe High School and the 20th anniversary of the Enloe Charity Ball, which now aims to raise $200,000 for Note in the Pocket. In its 20-year history, writes Jane Porter, Enloe Charity Ball, the high school annual student-led fundraising initiative and nonprofit, has never missed a fundraising goal. Seniors Noe Rourke and Shailen Fofaria, Enloe Charity Ball's Vice President of Publicity and Vice President of Outreach, respectively, said, this year's goal of $200,000 is daunting, but they are on track to reach it with continued support from the community and a strong final fundraising push this week. This was written on December 8th. If the students of the Southeast Raleigh High School reach their goal for their chosen beneficiary, Note in the Pocket, they'll mark Enloe Charity Ball's 20th anniversary, having raised more than $2 million total for local nonprofit groups in the last two decades. Rourke said, I'm staying optimistic. In an interview with Sir Walter Coffey this week with Indy, before Thanksgiving, joined by Fofaria, who is Enloe High's student body president, but the pressure is on. In 2004, Enloe student Rachel Escobar launched the first charity ball event and raised $2,000 in one night. Since then, skipping 2020 due to the pandemic, Enloe Charity Ball has grown to incorporate as a nonprofit, led by five student council representatives known as, quote, the Big Five. The Big Five students chair committees for publicity, outreach, finance, volunteering, and a day of logistics, with each committee composed of more than a dozen students. Fundraising events take place beginning in October and culminate in the dance held each year at Marble's Kids Museum in mid-December that some 1,500 people attend. All Wake County High School students are invited to the ball, and the public can purchase tickets. Anyone and everyone is welcome to make a donation to the fundraising, which is managed by the North Carolina Community Foundation. Last year, Enloe Charity raised $186,000 for the affordable housing nonprofit CASA. This year, the students chose Note in the Pocket out of 13 community nonprofits who went through Enloe Charity Ball's application process. Note in the Pocket, which also celebrates its 20th anniversary this year, provides local students facing clothing insecurity full wardrobes of clothes with dignity and love. Each student gets 5 10 tops, 5 bottoms, brand new socks and underwear, a pair of shoes and a coat, enough to last 2 weeks. Well, if I had brand new socks and underwear, anyway. Social workers identify students in Wake and Durham County schools who are in need of clothing and submit requests to Note in the Pocket with the personal preferences of the student. Trained volunteers choose clothing for each child as if they're choosing gifts for them, a detail that Rourke, who toured Note in the Pocket's North Raleigh facility with other students this fall, found touching. Explaining every bag of clothes they give to a child is hand-picked by a real person who's received information about the child. So the child's favorite color or some things they like dinosaurs, or if they have an event coming up and need a fancy dress, each piece is personalized to the child and they feel like they're not just getting hand-me-downs, but something they would be truly excited to wear. Note in the Pocket's development director, Meg Carpenter, said $200,000 will go a long way for the nonprofit at a time when the cost of living for local families continues to rise. They'll be able to add 2 staff members to their 18-member team who will help fill a growing number of requests, cover operating expenses, and buy clothes when needed. Most clothing is donated, though some specific sizes and styles are hard to keep in stock. Carpenter said families are trying to make their clothes last as long as possible, but that's really hard for kids whose feet grow really fast, who just grow really fast in general and are running out of clothes to wear. Rourke noted that the 27610 zip code in Southeast Raleigh, where Enloe is located, is Note in the Pocket's most served zip code. She said, this organization is operating within our school, within our middle schools, within our elementary schools. And we actually had no idea because all this work is happening so subtly. Throughout the fundraising season, Enlo students volunteer with Note in the Pocket twice a week. They also participate in several school events to raise money in increments that make sense for high school students, explained Fofaria. To raise money this year, Enlo Charity Ball hosted basketball, kickball, and pickleball tournaments, a tournament based around the popular video game Clash Royale, a trunk or treat event, and an alumni social in honor of the ball's 20th anniversary, among other events. After the ball, Enlo students will host a mini ball for the students at Hunter Elementary School, a Southeast Raleigh school that feeds into Enlo. Rourke spoke about planning these fundraising events. We were thinking, what's a fun way to get people who normally may not want to participate, and what's something that's so fun they'd be doing anyway? So that's what we came up with. This week, students will be selling coffee and hot chocolate in the morning before school ahead of the ball on Saturday. And while small donations add up, the Enlo Charity Ball attracts its share of big swing donors who contribute thousands of dollars. All the donors are recognized with a big check at the main event. And this year, the students will open the giant Money-Palooza piggy bank at Marbles, a popular request from attendees in years past. Fofaria explained, there's a lot of corporate outreach, reaching out to alumni, so we hit different target audiences, and our support comes from the masses. We don't have one specific place or a person donating, but we make a lot of money off tickets and some fundraising events. It's really cool to see how every year differs. It's always cool to try different outreach and see what works out. And finally, the ball takes place this Saturday, December 13th. Now, I'm recording this on the 11th. So, Marbles Kids Museum, downtown Raleigh. And it goes from 7 to 11 p.m. And you can click to make a donation from there's a website listed, but I don't have it printed out with me, to make a donation or to buy tickets to the ball. I'm going to, nope, there's no way. So just check out Enlo's charity ball on the web, and you'll find everything you need to know. We wish them a lot of good fortune in more ways than one. All right, a music-related article in its way. John Darnielle, area lyricist, composer who makes his home in Durham. Any story you tell, you wind up telling on yourself. It's his new book. He's the founder and frontman of the band The Mountain Goats and a National Book Award nominated novelist, and did not at first find the idea of a lyric book very compelling. His agent pitched the idea during the doldrums of 2020, assuming it would be a good pandemic project. But Darnielle knew he wasn't going to put his name on a simple copy and paste of the lyrics to his songs. He said over a Zoom call from his home in Durham, a lot of those are just the lyrics printed, and that seems weak to me. Even if you're a good lyricist, that's all on the internet. And if you're a great lyricist, I can hear it too. So instead of taking the easy route to a new book, Darnielle unpicked the structure of collected lyrics as a form and landed on something more akin to a devotional. The result, which took Darnielle years of writing and refining even to find his way into, is called This Year, 365 Songs Annotated, a book of days, published this month. Less than 4 weeks after the Mountain Goats' 23rd studio album called Through This Fire, across from Peter Balkan. Once he found a structure on which to hang his work, Darnielle chose 366 songs. The title, precise as it is, doesn't account for the presence of an entry for February 29th. From his dozens of albums, as well as decades of notebooks of unreleased or unrecorded work, Each song comes with some kind of commentary. There's everything from craft notes and autobiographical anecdotes to nods to the author's love for trees and to many subjects of his songs. The book is playful, discursive, loosely linear journey through decades of Darnielle's writing. Indie Week spoke to Darnielle about the process of putting This Year together, the line between fiction and memoir, affordable housing and God. This interview has been edited for length and clarity. So it's a Q&A. Q. In the intro, you mentioned the structure came at least in part from a psychedelic furs album. Were there also some nods to medieval books of ours? Darnielle. Yeah, I was thinking about that sort of thing, something that you consult. I was thinking about the way my first bassist, Rachel, when she introduced me to Rumi, she had a Coleman Barks translation, and whoever had given her the book said, oh, you open this book wherever, and the one you find is talking about where you're at now. I don't know where they got this idea, but it was cool, right? It was fun. It felt real. I love this kind of things. So you can consult this on your birthday, your anniversary, the day you sign your divorce papers. In the preface, you talk about selecting and arranging the songs. You say, the shape they trace now together resembles me. The songs beside which they first appeared would form a different view of the same person, but this one seems truer. Can you talk about that distance there? I hired a research assistant from Duke to get all of my songs to me, and when I looked at the ones that I hadn't picked, I was like, no, my instinct was right. Those are the parts of me that I've shed in some ways. Not all of them, but some of them. I'd go, oh yeah, there's a reason to write about this one other one off the tape and not this one. But also what I'm talking about there is how, when I was first doing this, if people would suggest that what I was doing was confessional in any way or was self-disclosure of any kind, I was very, very resistant to this idea. I now think of things differently. I think you can write a story about a mermaid who builds a spaceship, and you're still talking about yourself. Any story you tell, you wind up telling on yourself in some way, right? This has informed which stories I choose to tell, actually, which I think in turn then shapes you. I used to be much more interested in dark stories, where people have dark motives. And I mean, look, I still write novels that are incredibly violent, and that's in me, right? But the choices you make about what you write about do shape you and wind up presenting you with a picture of yourself. They present other people also with a picture of you, but that's a different picture because they bring their own stuff to it. And quite often that can be about a 51% balance of what they're bringing to what they see. So that's also an interesting thing. I think that the more I read, the more I believe all fiction is autofiction to some degree, and all memoir is also fiction. I think that's true. If you read Defoe doesn't think he's writing memoirs, but he's telling you a lot about Daniel Defoe. I find that interesting. To me, that would mean, good, now we don't have to write memoirs anymore. But most people feel different from me on that. You do say at one point, this isn't a memoir unless it is. How would you define memoir? Part of that is just me bitching about a thing that people who know me know I'm constantly bitching about. I get galleys, right? And for about 2 years there, it felt like 3 out of 4 were a memoir. And that's never going to the front of the queue for me. I want to hear fun, made-up stories. I care about people. If I meet people, I do want to hear their stories. But if I'm reading, I want to read something amazing that you made up. Then I'll actually learn more about you than in your curated and self-presented version of yourself. So many of the memoirs will be like, warts and all, he really lets you know what a piece of shit he was before he became good. Yeah, but you're picking the parts of that that you can stand to tell me, or you're playing them up to look tough, right? My other problem with memoir is that identity and self are malleable over time, and they're huge, right? They're huge. I think fiction does a better job of presenting the self by letting you have all these multiple selves that you made up doing various things, rather than attempting just to basically put on your makeup and say, here's what I look like when I describe myself. So both your artistic mediums, music and storytelling, are traditionally very experiential art forms. They weren't physical things for so long. Is there any dissonance for you between making these things that are meant to be experienced with people and having to force them into physical things? That's a great question, he answers, and I will eat up the rest of the interview on it. So here's the thing. What you're asking intersects with one of my hobby horse questions about the notion of spontaneity and what's real. Big old square scare quotes around that. Everything's curated. Everything's gathered and organized, right? Language does that also. Language is a performance of something that, before it becomes language, is formless. And so storytelling replicates what we do when we speak at all. It takes a bunch of chaotic notions and organizes them into a picture that we can both look at and have different reactions to. In making the book, what was interesting about it is how that stuff seemed to be then versus looking at it now. You talk a lot about the old version of you you're dealing with in this book, the person who wrote those songs. What's the difference between confronting that person in writing versus performing those songs? His answer, the thing is, a lot of these don't get performed at all. A lot of them are unlikely to get woken up like that. But performance is so much its own space. It's very different. Because I'm thinking about the words when I perform, but not in this way. I'm inhabiting them. I'm acting. But I'm acting something that I wrote, which is an unusual position for an actor. I don't like to talk about performance being therapy, but there's a therapeutic aspect to it. It's sort of as if you've been told, I want you to speak as if you were this person. Whereas writing is infinite. Writing is gathering every thought you have and trying to bring it down to one point. That's the miracle of it, right? Some people find that daunting, but I'm like, oh no. You go to the desk, then you open up the world. I love it. I love the little asides through the book where you're like, I'm not going to get going on this essay. In one of those you say, all writing is correction. I love this idea, but not sure I'm following you all the way. Give me the thesis to this craft essay. I don't think I talk about this in the book, but I liked to come up with a poetic theories back then because a lot of the poets that I would read belonged to schools. You know, the Polish poets were always having theories and stuff, and I developed an ethos whose details are lost to history called the theory of non-imagematic poetry that mainly concerned using phrases to advance the action and avoiding images where you can. As you'll note, I don't wind up pursuing this. But when you do anything like that, I think later you look at it and ask yourself, not just where did it succeed or not succeed, but you're responding to it. You're responding to what you wrote as you go. You also respond to how it was received as you go on, to whether it got not just praise or condemnation, but also to the feeling you think it evoked. Maybe you're not getting or not getting the ego gratification you want because some of that's going to be in writing that you choose to share. But I do think every time you write, you are, in some sense, rewriting what you wrote before. Now, that's a broad sense. It doesn't mean you're always telling the same story. It means that when you write, you are in some way correcting on your earlier attempts. I hope for myself that that's true, because I don't want to do the same thing twice. If I'm doing something in the same vein, I want it to be better than the previous time. It says that neither impulse can win. They can only conspire to push the style forward. I think that's true. If you land on a side, you become still. You become static. It's funny. Everybody wants to franchises, right? People want to read books in a series. I have very little interest in this. It's not a comprehensible aesthetic urge to me, the desire to hear the ninth story, see the ninth movie. Oh, this is a damned lie, though. I'm lying to you outright, because all the Friday the 13th movies, all of them. But partly what I like about that franchise is with Halloween 3, for example, the makers will go, what if it wasn't in the franchise at all? It doesn't have Michael Myers in it at all. I think the people who own that property were like, do we get to do the mask guy again? And that's my favorite, really, of the Halloweens, because that's what I think you should do. Say, here's what I did before. How can I interrogate that? How can I be in a conversation with that instead of just restating it or making it bigger? Question. Reading this, I was thinking red pen correcting like in school. But the way you talk about it sounds more like a course correction. Like we've got to shift the rudder a little bit to make sure we're saying where we need to go. Answer. Well, we're finding new waters. Make sure we're not going to the island we've already visited and filling out the map, because you're not going to fill out the map. You have a limited amount of time, right? And you will not get to all the places you could go. So you want as many as you can. That's the way I look at it. There's other ways of looking at it, but that's it for me. They got to send me more grad student interviewers. They got it, because I've had some experience yesterday. He stops the question. To bring up another one of your asides, I would love to open the floor to anything you have to say about mixed-use residential housing, perhaps in Durham, North Carolina specifically. Oh, my God, do you really want to hear it? I do. I've only lived here 5 years. The city is unrecognizable. It's crazy. Yeah, well, I mean, look, we moved to Durham in 2003. We moved to Durham because we could not afford to move to Chapel Hill. We had looked in houses in Chapel Hill, and they were out of our price range, so we moved to Durham, and it was hip as hell. You wouldn't recognize what downtown was. And Durham had this feeling of like nobody was quite sure what they were going to do with it, so empty buildings would remain empty. Mixed-use residential is only good if it contains an affordability component, and the affordability component should not be the one unit that we settled on, so we could say we're making housing affordable. Affordable housing in Durham, anybody who drives an 885 can see at the off-ramp, we need affordable housing. There are people who have no place to live in our affluent town, right? New construction is inevitable, but we should be building affordable housing. That's what we need in this town, and we should be building places with walkable space. We should always be putting sidewalks in. All this stuff is important, but they're making money instead. And that is a choice. And people don't actually like the result of that choice, except for the people who take the money home. You've talked both in the book and more generally about God and your radical politics. I'm also dealing with progressive faith in the age of MAGA, and just wanted to ask, how are you doing? Yeah, it's funny. So I'm a Jesus guy, too, and I don't think my wife will mind me sharing this anecdote. I was bewailing these people who would put, like, the science isn't in on whether vaccines cause autism on the CDC website. And my wife rather witheringly says, yeah, but these people believe in God. She had me dead to rights on that. It's an absurd proposition, right? But I'm fine is the thing. When you have enough privilege to be fine, you should state that first. Like when I'm scared, am I scared for myself? Well, next year I'm traveling internationally. I don't know how that's going to go when I come back in. But I'm not scared like 20% of the families that stayed home from the public schools today. And I'm angry about that. I'm angry that there are people whose children don't get to go play with their friends today. Young children, five-year-olds. If you've taken kids to kindergarten and preschool, you see them playing and you go, oh God, we've ruined the world. That's what we should be doing, playing together and supporting each other the way that classes of kids do. And instead, they're literally saying, you can't go to the school today and I can't go to work today. This is a horrible state of affairs. We should be very angry. People will say, well, what are you doing? I can't do anything. I'm just a person. We can only do things collectively. What I do, what I say, is only meaningful in the sense that I have a bit of a platform, so maybe some people will hear it. But until we unify and take collective action, we can't do anything. Nothing. Individually, we are nothing. Collectively, we are strong. And we know this, right? The bad guys know this, too. They wouldn't put it that way, but they know this. So, yeah, that's where I do feel hopeful. I went up to compare foods, and there was a group of people who looked like me, younger, but they looked like me. And they were there to bear witness and protect people if they were trying to shop at Compare or work at Compare and were getting hassled by fascists. And that was beautiful. That was collective action. So I'm seeing that in my community. It's beautiful to see Durham affirming that it is who we say it is. It's a place where we're trying our best to come together to protect our people. The privilege to see that and to be part of that in whatever small way. We need to keep that carrying forward to protect every disenfranchised class, you know, from immigrants to trans people to whoever else you can name who's on the receiving end of abuse from this administration. John Darnielle. All right, next, Indy selects what to do in the Triangle this week. Presuming, of course, you can get out of your home and are interested in going a couple of places. I'm recording this on Thursday, and the event that's scheduled for today I'm not going to tell you about because it's already going to by the first time. However, to do Saturday, December 13th at Gear House in Durham, the Up-Down Market. 'Tis the season for holiday markets and browsing irresistible handmade ornaments. The Up-Down Market expands on Durham's bustling market scene. Last week saw this month's patchwork market at the Armory with artist food and small business vendors that include loco pops, folded poetry, hyperlocal Durham roses, noodles, and sweets, and the Noir candle collection. If you're looking to make shopping a week-long affair, consider bundling up and hitting the December 11th Durham Holiday Night Market, which takes place under the Lucky Strike Tower on the Tobacco Campus. Bundle up, grab a drink from Full Stream Brewery, and enjoy live music as you browse goods from more than 30 local vendors. 2 to 6 p.m., Gear House, Durham, the Up-Down Market. Now, the Durham Symphony, we always hear from them about this time, playing a holiday pops show, holiday shows generally. This particular concert, though, is Saturday the 13th, and it's in the Rialto Theater in Raleigh, 5 points down in Raleigh, not right in the middle of town. Ring in the holidays with the Durham Symphony, one of the Triangle's first community orchestras, long-standing family event that features music to celebrate Christmas, Kwanzaa, Hanukkah, New York, and New York Year's, and Mardi Gras. Award-winning soprano soloist Jamisa Yarborough, known for her warm, powerful voice, will join the symphony's festive performance under the baton of Maestro William Henry Curry, long-time fixture, immense talent and charm in this area. The event will also have its traditional sing-along. Before the show, you can snag Santa photos at 6 p.m. The concert itself is at 8. At intermission, there will be a dessert buffet and hot cocoa bar with coffee and tea, too. Tickets will be available online starting at $38. Look for either the Rialto Theater or the Durham Symphony's website. That's a good orchestra. It's a lot of freelancing musicians and some regulars that perform that show. Another to hear is Sunday, the December 14th, at the Hayti Heritage Center, and that's the North Carolina Jazz Ensemble, a jazzy big band Christmas. Get in the holiday spirit and get your feet tapping with that ensemble's annual holiday concert, directed by Stanley Baird. We will feature vocalist Denise Barnes and special guest vocalist Leonard Rutledge, taking the traditional big band sounds of saxophones, trombones, trumpets, and a rhythm section at the, quote, virtually acoustically flawless performance hall, per the event description. Celebrate the season with a band of talented artists and educators who have played music in the region since 1980. Their general admission tickets are $25, but it's free for children 12 years and younger. Hayti Heritage Center, Sunday, December 14th, from 4 to 6 p.m., the North Carolina Jazz Ensemble. And let's see, the last one they mentioned, Thursday. Well, again, that's already gone by. So that's it for this particular article, What to Do in the Triangle This Week. They put this out. I'm forced to record this on Thursday. The first broadcast is on Friday, so things that have already happened, I don't even bother to tell you about. All right, let's see. I have 5 minutes left. Where can I go from here? Well, some of you, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and some of you may enjoy drinking wine. Don't know why I feel that, but I just do. So there's a new natural wine bar you might want to check out at Brightleaf Square. Jess Moffitt does not mind if you act like you're in a friend's living room when you're at Soul House, S-O-L, Soul House Wines, her new natural wine store that recently opened. She said of the vibes she wants for her new space, which serves as both a shop and a bar, "I want it to feel laid back and welcome and like you're popping over to a friend's house who knows a lot about wine." I personally don't know anyone who has over 150 types of wine at their house, but sounds like a great place to visit. Moffitt moved to Durham from New York City 2 years ago with her husband. At the time, she was still working remotely as a merch designer for musicians, but she got the itch to open a natural wine store and was anxious to see if she could make her dream a reality in Bull City. After being a regular on the New York City foodie circuit, Moffitt fell in love with natural wines after realizing that all the restaurants she loved the most served them. She said, "I started doing wine education in New York, making it up to the advanced WSET Level 3 certification level." Quote, "And that's when the wheels started turning and I started to think I wanted to switch industries and focus on natural wine 100% of the time." While still living in New York, Moffitt began picking up shifts at a wine store, confirming her passion for opening her own. Upon moving to Durham and settling into her new city, she went all in, opening Saul House Wines on November the 12th. "Defining what natural wine means can be somewhat open to interpretation," Moffitt said, "but at Saul House you'll find only organic or biodynamically farmed wines where there's been minimal intervention during the wine-making process. That means none of the wines have any additives like additional yeast, sugar, sulfites, or dyes." I'd heard that sulfites in wine contribute to hangovers, so I got really excited at this point in the interview, but Moffitt laughed when I asked her if drinking the wine from Saul House will mean no hangovers. She said, "It's a lower rate of hangover to drink natural wine, but I also say to drink water and make sure you're eating, so it's not 100% that you won't have one." Saul House will have 9 or so options by the glass that will change biweekly and about 160 different options to purchase. Moffitt tasted over 400 wines to make the initial selection and created an insane spreadsheet to try to balance everything from wine regions and varietals to price points. She said the sweet spot for most wines in the store is between $20 and $30, but we actually have a pretty decent selection of sub-20 bottles. That was important to me to have. The shop has a few bar snacks like olives, tinned fish, and almonds on offer, but customers are also welcome to bring your own food. You'll find 30 seats inside, as well as a few patio tables and chairs outside, so grab a few dips from recently Michelin-recommended Nikos next door, or a pizza from Emmy Squared around the corner, and have Moffitt help you pair a wine to go with. Saul House is also part of the Bullpen Social District, so once the branded cups get in, visitors can also have the option to grab a glass of wine and meander around. And finally, I can just begin and outline an article about Starpoint Brewery, which came out at the last day of October of this year. Sarah Edwards writes, "What would move someone to buy a brewery in today's market? Industry headwinds haven't exactly been positive. Tariffs, one reason, labor costs, inflation, etc. But for the new owners of Starpoint, the answer to that question is straightforward: community. Andy Morrison, new head of sales and marketing at Starpoint, all of us are residents of Durham. We're drawn to being able to be part of the actual liquid itself in a spot in Durham and have that kind of connection directly to the community that counts. I think for all of us, the part of the reason we enjoy being in beer is the idea of beer as a vessel for community." Sounds like they have a fairly good staff there. Andy Morrison is part of the new ownership team of Starpoint alongside Daniel Kulenik, who works at Senos, formerly Precision Fermentation, and will take on the mantle of CEO. Whit Baker, a partner in Bond Brothers in Kerry and Standard Beer and Food in Raleigh, who will work as Director of Operations. Carborough residents Harper and Beth Boylan founded Starpoint in 2012 after growing their small batch IPA operation out of a garage. In 2017, Starpoint moved to Durham, where the brewery shares a space with easygoing Rockwood neighborhood bar Beer Study, with some operations still run out of Carborough. With Harper retiring, the new owners say operations will shift entirely to Durham. The head brewer, Ken Hampton, will stay on in his longtime row, and Ziggy Sprinkle will round out the five-person team as a sales representative. All right, this is a podcast. I'm John Feddersen reading it to you. It will first be heard regular time Friday afternoons at ncreadingservice.org. After that, it goes into the bin of podcasts, and there's hundreds of them. So you can hear this or any part of any other article at Indie Week or The Independent at NorthCarolinaReadingService.org. It's from John Feddersen. Then thank you for listening, everybody, and we'll be back next week.